This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A fiery debate on Monday between Ohio's candidates vying for a Senate seat symbolizes a major political dynamic across the country as we head toward the November 8th midterm elections. Democrat Tim Ryan, who currently serves as a House representative, sparred with Trump-backed Republican candidate J.D. Vance, who's never held office. Although Donald Trump is no longer president, his influence within the GOP remains strong, and the elections are a test of the party's gambit to embrace extremism. Both the Senate and the House are in play, with the Democrats holding on to razor-thin majorities right now. Political pundits are reminding us that the party that loses the presidency usually gains seats in the midterm elections. But the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, in spite of abortion rights remaining popular, is a stark reminder of what Republican control has delivered. We turn to Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, a contributing editor at The Baffler and The New Republic, where he was formerly the editor of both publications. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So first, what did Monday night's debate between Ryan and Vance symbolize? Did it, as I mentioned, showcase this dynamic between Democrats and Trump-backed Republicans that are really proxy elections, if you will, for Trump and Trumpism?
Yes, well, Donald Trump is very much on the ballot, which is how Donald Trump likes it. Yeah, the makeover of J.D. Vance, you know, just a little bit of background here. Just prior to the 2016 election, he published his celebrated best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. He was then promptly anointed as a sort of mystic interlocutor of the white working class that everyone was hearing about after the 2016 election, kind of shocked the political establishment in America. And he was a vocal never Trumper. He, you know, claimed that Trump was accurately so, you know, a vicious bigot and a xenophobe, and did not reflect you know, the better angels of Americans' civic culture. And now the J.D. Vance we are seeing, you know, running for Senate in Ohio is a full-bore mini Trump. He, as Trump joked at a rally in Youngstown, J.D. Vance has been kissing Trump's ass to get his support. And Peter Thiel, one of the major funders of the GOP, has kicked in $15 million to Vance's candidacy. He has very much remade himself in the image of Trumpian politics. And we saw that in the debate last night. He went really hard after what he claimed is, you know, the open border, claiming that it has, you know, bred all kinds of social ills, from rampant fentanyl deaths in Ohio to the tragic case involving the 10-year-old who was raped and needed to go out of state to get an abortion. So it is a playbook of just hammering at these same issues of, you know, kind of white grievance and fear-based politics, and just demagoguing your way in a very blatant and, you know, in my view, amoral fashion. And, you know, that what's distressing is it seems to be working for Vance. The race is lately tightened in his favor. I didn't see anything in the debate, though I thought Tim Ryan did acquit himself creditably in the debate. Vance was clearly primed to go hard and hard right on all the issues under discussion. And I think I hate judging events in this sort of thumbs up, thumbs down way. But if I were forced to do so, I don't believe that Ryan, you know, did anything to stall Vance's momentum in the race.
So this, you know, this is Ohio. It went hard for Trump. in 2020 and 2016, and it was considered a safe Republican seat. But then with Vance being the Republican nominee for that seat, Republicans, sort of centrist Republicans, worried that by putting an extremist candidate forward, they might potentially lose a safe seat. But you're saying that Vance is giving Ryan a run for his money, which suggests that maybe this gambit to embrace Trumpism might work for the GOP.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing a lot of candidates. I just read a long profile of Carrie Lake, the gubernatorial candidate in Arizona, who's very much like, you know, the Southwestern version of J.D. Vance. She is a political novice. She is super media savvy. She actually records all her exchanges with reporters so that, you know, they can send out, you know, press releases alleging, you know, fake news from any interview that emerges. You're seeing this whole next generation of ambitious political leaders on the American right who are taking the Trump model as their blueprint. And, you know, I think in part because, you know, it's depressingly hard to get anyone to turn out in midterm cycles. So the group of people voting tends to be more extreme on both sides. And, you know, there is genuine anxiety about the direction of the economy and inflation. And the Democrats have sort of found their messaging has been scrambled a lot by that. So that creates a climate where this kind of dishonest, fear-based politics can really thrive, just as it did in 2016.
The New York Times did an interesting poll of voters recently and found that there were, you know, far too many Republicans who believed that the 2020 election was stolen and were likely to back candidates who also openly espoused this idea that the 2020 election was stolen. And it's interesting, though, when confronted by Democrats in debates about this, often Republican candidates tend to back down and assert what everybody knows and is well documented, that the election wasn't stolen. There's this tacit understanding that the January 6th riots were somehow legitimized, in Washington, D.C., were somehow a legitimate reflection of, you know, anger over a stolen election. There's just so much sleight of hand that relies on misinformation in this election that suggests that our democracy might be weaker than ever. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the absolute low points in the Vance Ryan debate was, you know, the panel tried to pin Vance down, you know, the kind of quid pro quo. It's been reported for Vance getting Trump support was Vance had to kind of sign off on the big lie about the 2020 election. And when he was pressed on this by the debate panel, Vance delivered this, you know, it did kind of make my jaw drop. He said, you know, obviously the events of January 6th were tragic, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there was a failure to honor the outcome of the 2016 election, referring, of course, to the Mueller investigation and allegations of Russian collusion, that was as bad as January 6th. And, you know, at that point, you just want to, you know, you want an adult in the room to, you know, say, you cannot say this kind of thing. It is, you know, it is a far, you know, I'm becoming inarticulate just describing it. It is so enraging that kind of, and that is, you know, now standard stump rhetoric across the Republican Party. So yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the question of our democracy in peril, because that is another, you know, there was a Times poll released today saying that voters agree that democracy is in jeopardy, and yet it is not one of their priorities. And I see that, you know, I mean, I will, you know, freely concede for structural reasons, I'm rooting hard for a Democratic takeover of, or a retaining power in both houses of Congress. But I do see that poll is evidence of a failure in messaging on the Democrats' part. You know,
right. And that was my next question. It shouldn't be that difficult to counter such blatant misinformation with adherence to justice, fairness, truth, facts.
Right. Or, traditions, yeah. The better angels of this country, we want this to be a democracy of one person, one vote. We want maximum participation in the system. We want, we don't want voter suppression based on race or access to wealth or anything else. I haven't seen that message, tied together in a really compelling way. I know it's difficult in many ways to say the democracy is in peril in 30-second soundbites, but the fact of the matter is, this is a crisis, and you don't get really to choose how you message around it. It is actually the case that if enough election deniers get governorships and secretary of state positions in this cycle, it just will take two or three swing states in 2024. If Trump runs again and doesn't get the popular vote, doesn't carry the appropriate swing states, these state officials could well, block the election results.
So the Senate,
you would have January 6th in the state houses of swing states.
So let's talk about the Senate and the dynamics. So currently, Democrats hold exactly 50 seats. And because they control the presidency, they can, Vice President Kamala Harris has been a tie-breaking vote. And so they cannot afford to lose even a single seat in order to lose control of the Senate. But there are more Republican Senate seats in play, as far as I understand, then what is the outcome that you expect? How close could this be? Because all it's going to take is a handful of seats going this way or that way to flip control of the Senate.
Well, I got out of the prediction business after the 2016 election. I didn't do that. Sure. But it is very tight. Races that the Democratic Senate caucus had been sort of banking as relatively safe are now up in the air. The Warnock-Walker race in Georgia and the Nevada race are both much too close to call. And, the worry is that, concerns about inflation and the economy are coming to predominate. And that, again, is an area where Democratic messaging is not really
I'm glad you brought up the Walker race with Warnock. I mean, Raphael Warnock is a very strong candidate. Herschel Walker didn't even show up to the debate. I mean, aside from the controversy around the fact that it now seems as though he almost definitely paid for the abortion of an ex-girlfriend while publicly opposing abortion, he didn't even show up to debate Raphael Warnock. And yet, he is a competitive candidate?
It is. I don't know Georgia politics at close remove, but it is the case in a lot of states, especially in the South, that voter suppression plays a very big role. It famously played a role in Stacey Abrams not winning in her first run for governor. I'm assuming that you're seeing a motivated base of GOP extremists and perhaps a less motivated or a diminishing level of motivation among the Democratic base. So what happens in midterms where you have low turnout across the board?
Right, and that's a huge challenge this year. Let's talk about the House. If you have any sense of the House, it ends up being in the last few races, at least, that Democratic candidates end up getting more votes and fewer seats. And we see the effects of gerrymandering in districts across the country. Do you expect something similar to happen in combination with low voter turnout?
Yeah, the House, I don't think, has ever been seriously in play for the Democrats, and less so now. So again, I'm not predicting, you know, things can still happen between now and the election, but yes, because so many House seats are drawn to guarantee incumbency and are drawn to favor, you know, most state houses are, or state legislatures are controlled by Republicans, and they draw the electoral maps, and they tend, not surprisingly, to favor Republican candidates. So yeah, I would be very surprised if the Democrats manage to take the House. It is still possible.
To keep the House. I mean, they have the House right now.
To keep the House. Yeah,
so what about the fact that the overturning of abortion rights has been, you know, something that almost cynically you've seen the Democrats use it as a way to get voters out. President Biden has said that Democrats will move to codify Roe, which is now overturned, into law, codify abortion rights into law. Democrats had some chances to do that over the past couple of decades, didn't do it. Anyway, now they're using it as a way to get voters to the poll. And there was some sense after the Supreme Court overturned the right to an abortion that maybe this would show voters just how dangerous Republicans are when they can control Congress.
Yeah, and I think that is still, obviously, it's an urgent and compelling issue, and the Democrats are definitely right to run hard on it. But I think, again, it's the case when these other sort of, you know, kitchen table kind of issues like the state of the economy loom larger, rightly or wrongly, the you know, there's a perception that, which I think is utterly mistaken, abortion access is an economic issue. If you're coercing people into motherhood, you are dramatically curtailing their life chances and their ability to participate in the economy. That is just true. But you don't, you know, I think, again, the Democratic messaging has largely been about individual rights and the threats that Republican control of Congress, and it's a real threat, posed to the access to reproductive freedom. But I think, you know, you also have to make it a case that's more than grounded in an individualist model of politics. And I think, again, that's where the messaging I've been seeing in congressional races doesn't really connect those dots.
Right. You've written about the Supreme Court, which of course is, you know, the way it is right now, courtesy of Trump and the Republicans, Mitch McConnell in particular, of bending rules to ensure that we now have a conservative supermajority on the court. And you also mentioned earlier the issue of voting rights is a big case that has been in play in the Supreme Court. How has the Supreme Court, in its current configuration, ensured Republican minority rule, or will continue to ensure Republican minority rule?
Well, you know, in a very flagrant way. I mean, I think it's important always to remember that John Roberts was a voting rights attorney under the Reagan administration, and his mission was to suppress voting rights. That has been, you know, a formative influence in his career, and he sees this issue in a very sort of quasi-partisan, ahistorical way. This is why it's so frustrating when people, you know, kind of say that the Supreme Court has to be above politics somehow. These are all, you know, Brett Kavanaugh was a career Republican flack, and same for Amy Coney Barrett. An interesting factoid is that Roberts, Coney Barrett, and Kavanaugh were, or I'm sorry, Neil Gorsuch, were all down in the 2000 Brooks Brothers riot, when in Florida, when the outcome of the 2000 presidential election was up for grabs, they were manning the legal team for the Bush campaign. So to sort of, you know, make believe and close your eyes all of a sudden that these same people are these Olympian characters who can stand above the fray and pronounce the way things should be is a ludicrous claim. And we're seeing now it is an ideological hard right court with, as you say, an ironclad 6-3 majority. So yeah, there's this awful voting rights case up before the court this term that will essentially say, if it's decided in the favor of, and it propounds this theory of the independent legislature that can basically determine the outcome of a presidential balloting under its own steam. And again, that would unleash, a kind of state by state wave of, what Trump wanted in 2020, negating valid election results and just putting up your own pet candidates. It is an appalling thing, and it could very well happen. And if that happens in conjunction, as I said, with these election denying governors and secretaries of state, we are looking at, the idea of democracy in peril is not just rhetoric. We will stop being a functioning democracy at that point.
I want to thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today. We'll post a link to your articles in The Nation from our website. Thanks and good luck to you.
Great. Thank you very much.
My guest has been Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, a contributing editor at The BAFRA and The New Republic, where he was formerly the editor of both publications. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.